Exodus chapter 18 verse 13 to chapter 19 verse 25. The 20th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 23, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 18, Exodus 18:13 to 19:25, accompanies this talk.
We'll begin Exodus chapter 18, verse 13 is where we'll start. Last week, we talked about three events that all occurred at Rephidim. We don't know where Rephidim is, but it is somewhere between the Gulf of Suez. They've been going down the east coast of the Gulf of Suez, and now they've turned north, kind of northwest, and they're going up into the mountains towards Mount Sinai. And Rephidim is someplace on that ascent towards Mount Sinai. And the first event that we talked about last week, where they ran out of water, this is a Rephidim. They ran out of water, they became angry and accused Moses of bringing them out into the desert to die. Moses then appealed to God, and God said, Moses, go out and strike the rock with the staff, which he did. And when he did so, water poured out, and they were supplied with water for themselves and their flocks. So God once again took care of their water needs. The second one was when the Amalekites came, and we aren't sure exactly what's happening. The Amalekites, generally speaking, were further north, Sinai Peninsula is where they live, but they came down to the southern part and were threatening the Israelites. So Moses told Joshua to pick some soldiers out of their midst and take them out into battle against the Amalekites. While Moses went up on a hilltop and he raised the staff with his arms, and when he got tired and lowered the staff, the Israelites would lose. But if he raised the staff, then the Israelites would win. And so the question was, how does he keep that staff raised? And Aaron, his brother, and Hur both helped him to keep his arms raised and the staff raised, and the Israelites were able to rout the Amalekites. And the third incident was one in which Jethro, who is Moses' father-in-law, came and greeted Moses, and it was apparently a very warm greeting, and he wanted to know from Moses everything that had happened in Egypt and on their journey through the Sinai. And Moses told him everything, including the bad things that happened. And Jethro, having listened to all of that, and apparently in detail and at some length, became convinced that Yahweh is the one true God. And as a result, then, Jethro worshipped with the elders of Israel and Moses. They sacrificed and then ate together, worshipping Yahweh. So those are the three incidents that we looked at last week. This week now is going to continue with some conversation between Jethro, who is Moses' father-in-law, and Moses. Starting with verse 13 in chapter 18 of Exodus. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning until evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and make known the statutes of God and his laws." So this is the next day after Jethro had joined the elders and Moses in worshiping Yahweh. The very next day, he sees Moses doing something, and it's not clear how often Moses did this, but he is spending the whole day judging disputes that have arisen among the people of Israel. It is not clear why there are so many grievances that have developed, and I'm not sure whether we are to see this as being that there is some problem that there are so many grievances. This is talked about in Deuteronomy, and I suspect that that's what's being suggested in Deuteronomy, is that there are more disputes than should be expected. But I'm not positive of that, and that is certainly not stressed in this chapter. There may be pent-up grievances. It could be that there's been some time since the last time that Moses judged disputes between the people. It is the case that we've got a significant number of people, and they are not all Israelites. We know that there were some others that joined them, some from Egypt, Egyptians, and there may have been other slaves from other areas that joined them as well. And it could be that as a result, there are differences in cultural backgrounds and therefore mores that may have led to additional disputes. In any case, there are a number of disputes, and people are coming to Moses because they want to know what God, it says, because the people come to me to inquire of God. So presumably what they want to know is how God would judge this particular situation. So they come to him, he makes a judgment, and helps the people to learn what it is that God would have them do. And that takes him all day long. Jethro is amazed at this because Moses alone is doing all of this. So in 17, he gives his counsel. And Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk, and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. And let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace." So Jethro has observed this, and he's concluded, this is not a good situation. This is a problem, because it is such a burden to place on Moses that Moses is going to wear out. But he's not just concerned about Moses. The people will wear out as well. The people will not get justice delivered in a timely fashion. I can't remember where it comes from, but justice delayed is justice denied, is a saying that, and there's some truth in that. It is too disruptive when people have grievances that can't be addressed in a timely manner. So this is not a good situation, and Jethro has a proposal as to how to solve this problem. And his proposal is that Moses will continue. He needs to continue to be the one who takes disputes to God and offers his judgment as to what God would do in those particular situations. But he needs to be doing something else, and that is he needs to be spending more time teaching them the statutes and the laws and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. If they know better what they are supposed to do, if everyone knows that, then it will be much easier to judge. They'll know what they should be doing. Some of them will modify their behavior, and everybody else knows what they should be doing. The other thing that needs to happen is Moses needs to select out of the people of Israel some capable men to whom he can delegate this task of judging the disputes. And it will be a tiered system of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Now, there is debate about whether these numbers are really significant or whether we're just talking about different levels. In any case, it's a tiered system. in which someone who has a dispute, they go to the lowest ranking judge. And if that lowest ranking judge decides that it is too difficult for him to judge, then it goes upstairs to the next level. So it's similar to the appeals process that we have in our judicial system. And eventually then, the hardest cases would end up on Moses' desk, and Moses would judge those. Now, the kind of men that need to help Moses in this are able men who fear God, they're men of truth, and they hate dishonest gain. That's a wonderful description of the kinds of people that need to be in those positions of standing and in judgment over disputes. The first, who fear God. In my studies of Russian history, it often came up that there is a real difference between a king, a tsar in Russia, and a king in Europe. A huge difference. And the difference is that the tsar in Russia, and this is largely under the influence of the Mongol legacy in Russia, the tsar in Russia is seen as the autocrat above whom there is nothing higher. The king in Europe, they were considered to be the supreme leader, but there was always this perspective that the king in Europe had to stand judged by God. There is a church in Prague that I have not seen, but I saw it on a Rick Steves thing. And this church had three entrances at the front of the church. And one of those entrances was only used on one occasion, and that is when someone became king. There was a ceremony to crown somebody king. And above that door is the last judgment. And that makes a huge difference. That if someone in authority knows that someday they are going to have to give account for everything that they do before the creator of everything, that makes a huge difference in the way they think about their power. So fear God, that's huge. The second, men of truth, that is, people for whom truth matters. Now, it seems to me that that has an impact in a couple of ways. One is, if you care about truth, then you care about the details of the incident. You want to know what happened, as opposed to what is revisionist history, what is a tale that's being told. And if you care about truth, it makes a difference. You need to know what it is that actually happened. And to have a judge who cares what actually happened is significant. And the other way in which a love of truth is significant is truth in the bigger sense. That is, what is true? Who is God? What are his values? Those are true things. And it is important that such a judge also be a man of truth in that sense. And then those who hate dishonest gain. That is to say, those who can't be influenced, those who can't be bought off. It's those who are so dedicated to the truth and to their fear of God that they don't care what person tries to apply influence to them, and they don't care about dishonest gain or bribes and that sort of thing. A wonderful description of the qualities that a judge needs to have in order to provide true justice. Okay. So that's the proposal that Jethro makes. And he says, if this is what God wants, this would be a good solution to the problem. In verse 23, if you do this thing and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. So Moses will be spared the burden. He'll be able to continue doing what he's doing without taking all of his strength. And the people will be able to go home in peace. There will be justice and peace in the society. Verse 24. So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And they judged the people at all times. The difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way into his own land. So Moses did what Jethro had suggested. He implements this policy, establishes this institution, and then Jethro goes home, and I'm sure Moses bade him a very warm farewell. One of the important parts about this section is that, as we saw last week, where Moses delegated to Joshua the task of putting together an army and commanding it in the field, and where he needed the help of Aaron and Hur to keep his arms raised so that the Israelites would win, Moses is seeing that he alone cannot provide the leadership that Israel needs. So he's taking steps to decentralize that to a certain extent, to delegate that authority out and allow others to participate in this process. And this is not only is this going to save Moses, allow him to function for the next 40 years and carry out the duties that he has, but we're setting up a system that can continue after Moses dies. And I think both of those are important and both of those are in view here. The other thing I find interesting in this section is that here we have a proposal that's coming from someone other than God and someone other than another Israelite. Moses seems to be quite content to take a suggestion from outside of their community as to what they should do to address this particular problem and to implement it. And I find that very interesting. Okay. Next section, chapter 19, verse 1. In the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." Now, the first matter here is, where is Sinai? And this is something that is disputed. It's not clear where Mount Sinai is. What I'm going to tell you is essentially Hoffmeyer's rendition, is his assessment of where it is. And from my perspective, that seems the most reasonable to me. What he says is that there are three things that must be met by any candidate for this place. The first is that it is not in Midian, but it is near Midian. The second is that it's about 150 to 200 miles from Yam Suf, that's the Red Sea or the Reed Sea, where they crossed it. And the third is that it be about 165 miles to 220 miles from Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea, and that criterion is based on Deuteronomy 1:2, where it says, I think it's 11 days, so that it's 11-day journey from Kadesh Barnea to the Promised Land. And so that translates into about 165 to 220 miles. Okay, so those are the three criteria that this location has to meet. First of all, the term Mount Sinai is often used interchangeably with Horeb. But there are passages where it says that the law was given at Horeb. There are others where it says that it was given at Mount Sinai. It appears to be the case that one of those is describing a region and the other one is describing something more specific, the actual peak. And it would appear that Horeb is probably the term that refers to the region and that Sinai is referring to a specific peak within that region. So it's like the Wallawas. Horeb would be the equivalent of the Wallawas, and Sinai would be the equivalent of one peak in the Wallawas. I don't know the name of any of the peaks in the Wallawas, but whatever, Eagle's Peak or whatever. So that's kind of the equivalent. Okay, the candidates for what would be Mount Sinai. There are some who think that Mount Sinai is in the northern or central Sinai. And as Hoffmeyer argues, the problem with that, and there are three peaks that are candidates, Gebel Hillel Har Karkom and Gebel Sin Bishir. From Hoffmeyer's perspective, all of those are precluded by, in particular, the criterion number three, that those are all too close to the promised land. Oh, I'm sorry, when I said the third criterion is Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. I'm sorry, I said Kadesh Barnea to the promised land. That's not right. From Sinai to Kadesh Barnea is 11 days. The northern and central Sinai candidates don't work because they are too close to Kadesh Barnea. In fact, Kadesh Barnea is in the central Sinai. The candidates in Edom, and the reason that some people think that it must be located in Edom, and if you look at the maps in your Bible, you can see where Edom is located. It's just southeast of Palestine. There are a number of passages in the prophetic works in the Old Testament that say that God came out of Edom. And so their assumption is that Mount Sinai must be in Edom because it's saying God came from there. But this location, again, doesn't meet the third criterion. That is, it's too close to Kadesh Barnea in order to work. And one can account for that expression that God came out of Edom in another way. That is, that when the Israelites came into the promised land, they passed through Edom, and they brought with them the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle. So there's a sense in which God did come out of Edom. He just passed through Edom, but he did come that way. The third area that is suggested is northern Arabia. In fact, it would be northwestern Arabia. And the reason that this one is attractive is because there are no volcanic sites in the Sinai, and no mountains in the Sinai that have been volcanic in historic times. The closest volcanic peaks to the Sinai are in northwestern Arabia. And so that's why that's attractive then, because as we read through this and reading further in Exodus, there are a number of phenomena that are associated with the giving of the law and with Yahweh coming down that are volcano-like, the smoke, the fire like a furnace, the quaking, loud noise. So there are a number of phenomena that could be associated with volcanoes, and so there are some people who really like the idea of a volcano being Mount Sinai. And in particular, Colin Humphreys is attracted to that explanation. So he goes to great lengths to explain how the Israelites must have, the route that they must have taken to get from Egypt to Mount Sinai, if Mount Sinai is in northwestern Arabia. And he has them crossing the Red Sea when they cross the Gulf of Aqaba. He thinks that is the Red Sea that they crossed. As Hoffmeyer points out, that is difficult. It's hard to account for, given the narrative in Exodus, it's hard to account for all the miles that they traveled from Egypt to get to the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Pharaoh's chariots following them. Apparently that the Sinai would have been very difficult for those chariots to cross unless they go across the very northern edge, and that takes them out of the region. So Hoffmeyer dismisses that. He doesn't think that northwestern Arabia is really a likely possibility. So southern Sinai is the place that seems most likely. It is the traditional location. That is to say, there are Christians who went there in the 3rd and 4th century A.D. and identified that as Mount Sinai, that location, especially the location where the monastery is, St. Catherine's Monastery. So that's relatively late that it was identified that way, but since then it has been the traditional date, and it's not known on what basis those Christians made the determination that that was Mount Sinai. Was it on local information, or was it just guessing, and we don't know? But that is the traditional location. There may be some substance to that tradition. The area has some interesting environmental advantages. We know that the Israelites were there for almost a year. I think it's 11 months that they park right there at the base of Mount Sinai. As I pointed out before, the Sinai is hot, especially in the summer, quite hot. But this is at 7,000 to 8,000 feet. It's much more moderate there than it is down at the lower elevations, especially in the summer. That's important. Also, although it doesn't get much rain, as I mentioned last week, all the rain runs off. Very little absorbs into the soil. So the water hits, it all runs down into these pools, and it runs down into areas where there is relatively good soil. So the kind of agriculture that can be conducted there, even though they only get a couple inches a year, is more like what could be done in a place where you get 15 inches of rain per year, 12 to 15. So that's a very interesting feature of this area. And the soil in those pockets is quite good and quite fertile. So the two peaks that are the most frequently mentioned candidates in southern Sinai are Gebel Musa and Gebel Serbal. They're just 30 miles apart. It's Gebel Musa that is the traditional site, and that's where St. Catherine's Monastery is located. In any case, it's thought that that's the most likely location, one of those two peaks. Okay, at the beginning of chapter 19 then, they've been underway for 2 months, starting into the third month. So it is now June, probably, maybe beginning July. So we're getting into the real summer months now. But they have been going into the higher elevations for 2 or 3 weeks now. They have entered into the wilderness of Sinai, it says. This is the third wilderness that's been identified, but unfortunately we don't know where any of those wildernesses are. The first was the wilderness of Shur, and we know that it is close to Egypt, but we don't know exactly where it's located. The next one is the wilderness of Sin, and we know that that's further east, but we don't know exactly where. And now the wilderness of Sinai is even further east. It is sometimes argued that the wilderness of Sinai is a portion of the wilderness of Sin. But unfortunately, this is all stuff that is speculative. We don't really know where they're located. In any case, the wilderness of Sinai is apparently the place where Mount Sinai is located. And the traditional location is a rather desolate area. It's arid and quite desolate, very rugged. They camp at the base of this mountain. The mountain in this passage is not named. It just says that Moses went up to the mountain. It was not named earlier in Exodus when God spoke to Moses. It's called the Mountain of God in Exodus 3:1. And at that time, when God was speaking to Moses, he said that he would bring him back here to worship. So Moses knew that he'd be coming back to this mountain. This mountain is familiar to him, and this is where he did indeed return. When they get here in camp, Moses takes the initiative to go up the mountain to meet with God. And God speaks to Moses while he's on the mountain, and he makes this proposal. He says that the Israelites have seen the miraculous things that God has done. All the things that God did to get them out of Egypt, the things that he inflicted on the Egyptians and on the Pharaoh, and all of the things that he did after they left Egypt. So they have been eyewitnesses to all of this that God has done. And so he makes, on the basis of that, he says, "If you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession, my special people among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine." What an amazing offer. God is saying, I am going to make you a special people out of all the people in the world. I'm going to make you a special people. You are going to have a unique relationship with me. And all that I ask is that you obey my voice and keep my covenant. And he goes on to say, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. A kingdom of priests, I think, in the sense, just as a priest in Israel plays a unique role in the society of Israel, that is to say that they play an intermediary role between the people as a whole and God, and they take requests from the people to God, and they take commands from God to the people. So they're intermediaries. The nation of Israel will play that same role with respect to the rest of the world, that they will take requests to God on behalf of all the people of the world, and they will take God's commandments from God and communicate them to the rest of the world. And a holy nation, that is, a nation that shares the holiness of God. Verse 7. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud, in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord also said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people, and you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, 'Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether beast or man, he shall not live.' When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain." So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman." So Moses, having talked to God and having received this proposal that God had made, he goes and he talks to the elders of the people, and he tells them what this offer is. And presumably the elders then take that word to all of the Israelites, and presumably they discuss this and vote. But in the end, the word comes back in verse 8. The people say all together, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." So they are agreeing to the terms of this arrangement. Moses then reports that back to God, and God says, "I'm going to come and visit you, and I'm going to come in a cloud. I'm going to come in a cloud and descend upon the mountain, and I will speak to you. But I'm doing this in order that the people may hear when I speak to you and may also believe in you forever." So they won't see God, but they'll hear God. They'll hear God speaking to Moses, and they'll know that what Moses heard was indeed what God had spoken, and that will be remembered forever. Then Moses reports to God that they agreed to what he had proposed, and so God says, "Okay then, we need to seal the deal. I want you to tell the people that they need to consecrate themselves. They need to do that for 2 days, and on the third day I will come and visit. And what they need to do in order to consecrate themselves is to wash their clothes." It doesn't say anything else right there, but in the last verse 15, "Don't go near a woman," so to be sexually pure for those 3 days. Then on the third day, God is going to come down in this cloud in the sight of all the people, but it's important that everyone understand that there are bounds set around this mountain. They are not to come on the mountain itself. They can come up to it, but they aren't supposed to go onto the mountain. Anyone who does go onto the mountain, that person is supposed to be put to death. And not just persons, but animals as well. Any people or animals that go onto the mountain, they are to be killed, and they are to be killed without touching them. So kill them either by stoning or shooting them with an arrow, but they aren't to be touched. When the people hear the ram's horn, the trumpet sound, then they're supposed to come up to the mountain, and they know that it's time for them to come up to the mountain, but just up to it, not onto it. So Moses reported that to the people, And they all consecrated themselves and washed their garments and prepared for that third day. Verse 16. So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So it's the third day. God does come as he said that he would, and it's accompanied by thunder and lightning. There's the cloud that he said would be there, and there's a very loud trumpet sound. And apparently this is not an Israelite blowing a trumpet, but there's a trumpet sound that is heard. I'll just point out that the trumpet, I think that the trumpet signalizes that time when the sacred and the profane come together. But there are a number of times that trumpets are talked about. There's a trumpet blown when the Sabbath begins and when the Sabbath ends. My hypothesis at this point is that the trumpet symbolizes that point in time when there is a coming together or a parting of the sacred and the profane. Verse 18. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. And the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain. And Moses went up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down, warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them." And Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou didst warn us, saying, 'Set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it.'" Then the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break forth upon them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. So God comes in the cloud, and then there's smoke, and there's fire, and there's the smoke of a furnace. The mountain is quaking violently, and there's the sound of the trumpet. All of this is evidence of the fact that God in all of his holiness is present. And Moses goes up to him on the mountain, but the first thing God says to him is, "Go back down and warn the people. Tell them, don't come on the mountain." And even the priests are told, and they have to consecrate themselves, but even they are not allowed on the mountain. Only Moses and Aaron with him are allowed to come up on the mountain. So there are three times that the people are warned, don't come on the mountain. Umberto Casuto points that out and says, "The purpose of the thrice repeated injunction may be twofold. One, to stress still further the thought that the boundary between the two spheres, the human and the divine, is not to be effaced. And second, that it was necessary to repeat the warning at the crucial moment when the revelation was about to take place." But the emphasis of doing it three times is striking. Now, who are the priests that he would be talking about here? That's not clear, because we haven't yet had the priesthood established. It could be, there's some commentators that suggest that the firstborn, where it says that the firstborn were consecrated to God, and it could be that the firstborn were considered priests at this point in time. Or it could be that heads of household who made offered sacrifices would have been considered priests. It's just not clear. But there must have been some people who were considered, even at this time before the law is given, considered to be priests. Okay, there are three things about which I would like to make some comments. The first is the holidays in Israel, the ancient holidays established in the law. There are seven of those holidays. There is a cluster in the spring, Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the first fruits. That's all in a one-week period. In the fall, there's another one-week series, the Festival of Trumpets, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. Then in the summer, there is one more that just lasts one day, and that is Shavuot, that is the Festival of Weeks. The Festival of Weeks is odd in that it's not clear from the Old Testament what that festival is all about. Why are they doing it? Unlike the others. And so scholars have tried to figure out what is this festival all about. And it is generally assumed that it began, and it could have begun even before the time that we're reading about here, as an agricultural festival. That is, when the barley harvest was done, then they had this festival. But whatever its origins were, we know that before the time of Christ, that this particular festival was celebrated in a commemoration of God giving the law to the Israelites. It is in commemoration of just what we read about, right, in chapter 19 and then going on into 20. And the reason I think that that association was made is because if you calculate where they are chronologically, that when this happens corresponds with when Shavuot is celebrated. As a result, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes made this particular holiday, it was a huge holiday for them. It was very important, and they wrote about it extensively. So we know that by the time of Christ, that association was made, and this festival becomes a more significant festival than it seems to have been historically. Interestingly, then, Shavuot in the New Testament is Pentecost. And so the Holy Spirit comes in Acts 2 on this particular holiday. And I'm confident that there is a divinely intended connection between those. Second thing I want to talk about. It is interesting to me that there seems to be law before the law, that there's some sense of law before the law is given in Exodus. We have Moses who is judging and teaching the law. We have the people, they are supposed to consecrate themselves, and this seems to be something that they are familiar with. We have priests before the law is given. So the question is, where does this come from? And it could be that it's divinely revealed to them even before the law is given. But I think it's more likely that what's happening is they are just trying to figure out how to live life by their best lights, given their situation. They've come out of Egypt. How are we going to organize ourselves? How are we going to worship our God? How are we going to carry out justice? All that sort of thing. And they're using their knowledge of Egyptian culture and probably other surrounding cultures and trying to take the best of that and live by their best lights. But in the next few chapters, God is going to give them the law that they are to follow. I'm sure that much of it corresponds with things that they had already decided were good and true. But there will be some things where it diverges, and they will be developing a whole culture around the values of the law that God gives them on Mount Sinai. The third thing I want to talk about is the thing that I think is clearly being stressed in chapter 19, and that is the holiness of God. They are told three times that they are not supposed to approach this mountain. And we've got these natural phenomena that are occurring that had to have instilled in them a sense of fear and reverence and awe and wonder at what's going on, what's going to happen, what's this all about. I think that the mountain being holy is important because, not because the mountain is all that special. The only thing that makes the mountain special is God is there. Were God not there, it wouldn't be special. So it's not inherently special. But God has established that as a place that no one is supposed to go. And what he's trying to teach by that, I think, is a spiritual value, and that is there is no coming together of the sacred and the profane. They are antithetical to one another. They cannot mix. And if they are to come in together, then we as human beings that are profane need to be purified, where that imperfection is taken away, the corruption is removed. It seems to me that we live in a culture where holiness is a difficult concept. I was thinking, if the temple were to be rebuilt, my suspicion is that tourists would want to take a selfie of themselves standing before the Ark of the Covenant We just don't have a sense of certain things being holy and something that I cannot transgress upon. And that extends to all kinds of things. I mean, we feel free to redefine what murder is, to redefine what marriage is, redefine what theft is. We feel very free to change things and make them according to our liking because there's nothing that transcends us. The 50% majority is the highest authority there is. It is interesting, in looking at this passage, and I was thinking about it, it is striking to me that God doesn't enforce this restriction. God could have said, if anybody steps on the mountain, I will zap them. He doesn't do that. He says, if anybody steps on the mountain, you need to kill him, either stone him or shoot him with an arrow. And that's in contrast to the manna. The manna was a really interesting pedagogical device, and I talked about this before. They were told not to keep it overnight. What happened if they kept it overnight? It developed worms. It was self-enforcing. No one had to do that. No one had to go around and determine who had kept some overnight. They weren't supposed to collect it on Sunday. If someone cheated and they went out to collect it on Sunday, they couldn't. It wasn't there. It's self-enforcing. That is extremely rare in what God does. For the most part, God has turned it over to human beings to enforce and instill those values that he has established. So, if anybody goes on the mountain, God's not going to zap them. It is the Israelites, it is that society which has the obligation to enforce that. And what's fascinating about that is if Israelite society stops enforcing that, then it ceases to have the value. It ceases to be holy. We cease to understand it as holy. So it's a societal thing that has to happen in order for that value to be instilled and maintained. And if that breaks down, then it all becomes profane. I think that another thing that makes this holiness a difficult concept for us, and I struggle with this without question, and that is, God is such a gracious God. He is constantly willing to forgive. He's constantly willing to be patient. And the risk that he runs is the same risk that any of us run as parents. What if you have a rule for your child, but every time your child violates the rule, you say, I forgive you, not a problem. If you do that every time, the child eventually is going to assume that this rule doesn't matter. It's like it's not there. And God is a very gracious God who forgives many times over. And it is easy then to see him not as the holy God, our creator and the creator of the universe, who tolerates no profanity. It's easy to lose track of that. He's my buddy. He's always there for me. He's always forgiving me. And to lose track of the fact that he is a holy God. And those things that I do that are wrong are nevertheless abhorrent to him and wrong. It is important, I think, for us to keep in mind that God is a fearsome God. And the prophets keep bringing that up, and I've been reminded of it. He is a fearsome God. He's patient, and he's loving, and he's forgiving, but he is a fearsome God. And one day he will come in judgment. And as the prophets say, God will not be mocked. Okay, questions? Comments. Father, I am extremely thankful for your graciousness towards us, all that you've done for us. We are sinners. We are profane. And it is remarkable that you have seen fit to make provision for us, and that you have made provision that our sins could be washed away and that we could be in your presence. And I pray that you will help us to keep in mind and to learn better who you are, what you're up to, what you value, what you hate. And I pray that you would help us to learn to conform our values to yours and to come to love you for the God that you are rather than something else. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks.